Colleges across the country have closed hundreds of foreign language programs in recent years. Wisconsin higher ed not immune to this trend, and we're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The MLA, the Modern Language Association, released some new figures last month, and a full report is coming out on the net loss of language programs. What do you think is behind the declining number of foreign language classes? Do you study a foreign language in high school, perhaps college? And if so, did that knowledge help you in your career? College students, let's hear from you. Are you majoring in a foreign language? Why did you pick that major? We're at 800-642-1234. You can go ahead and email your thoughts to ideas@wpr.org. Kathleen Stein-Smith is an associate university librarian at Fairleigh Dickinson University. She's taught foreign languages at the high school and college level and has written several books and numerous articles on the U.S. foreign language deficit. Her recent piece for the website The Conversation is titled "Foreign Language Classes Becoming More Scarce." Kathleen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to talk with you this morning about this important question of foreign language learning in our country.
So the MLA comes out with these numbers late last month that between 2013 and 2016, colleges across the country closed more than 650 foreign language programs. What is your reaction when you hear those numbers?
You know, as a foreign language educator and advocate, I am obviously sad to hear that. One thing, though, that we do need to keep in mind is that the headline read 651 programs. But for the purposes of the survey, programs, it really has to be translated as course offerings in a given semester. It's not necessarily always an entire department. It can be, of course.
I see. So it's basically the offerings, and perhaps it's not the entire major.
You know, in some cases, yes. So, and we will know more when the entire report is released.
What explains this? Why are colleges and universities dropping these programs, dropping these offerings?
You know, reasons that have been given include the fact that these are still lingering effects of the Great Recession. Some people have said that students may not be aware of all the advantages of foreign languages, career advantages particularly. However, I think also there is a question of opportunity. Not a lot of students in the United States study foreign languages in the elementary, middle, and high schools. Really just under 20%, according to the most recent statistics. And if only 20% of our children have the opportunity and are studying foreign languages at the age when it's really best to be a language learner, then that pool, that potential pool of learners at the college level is smaller than it might be. And those numbers have really dropped at the elementary and middle school level over the past 20 years.
Do you find that college students would say, well, I would have had to start working on this major many, many years ago. I can't major in this in college. I don't have the background in the language.
You know, that is true, but it's not necessarily entirely true. If we offer languages and give the opportunity for students to learn from the very earliest grade levels, as they do in Europe and in other parts of the world, you would have students arriving at college age or arriving at college and university with proficiency, even fluency. And, of course, then it's much easier to major in a language. It's easier to think about it.
We're talking about the decline of foreign language instruction, the closure of programs, courses with Kathy Stein-Smith. She's an associate university librarian at Fairleigh Dickinson University, written extensively about America's foreign language deficit. Join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is behind the declining number of foreign language classes? And what do you think it would take to reverse this trend? call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy, isn't this more of like a supply-demand thing? I mean, if colleges aren't filling seats in these courses, in these programs, how can they afford to offer them?
You know, that is a very good question. You know, colleges, like the rest of our society, were impacted by the economic recession. I think, however, there's a deeper problem. You know, the historian Peter Stearns, he wrote that American reluctance to learn other languages is legendary. And that's a quote. That's the word that he used. And I think what it is, people may not realize the benefits of languages. You know, for example, in addition to the ability to speak and to communicate with others, which is the obvious advantage of foreign language learning and foreign language learning from an early age, it can result in higher test scores. It can result in better reasoning skills. It can result in a divergent thinking, or creativity, basically. And parents and communities, actually, I think I'm starting to see the beginning of a turnaround. Parents and communities are across the country and in Canada are really advocating strenuously for foreign language programs, specifically for immersion programs. And that's where really children from the very earliest grades have an opportunity not only to learn another language, but to also learn about the culture. And in dual language immersion programs, they have the opportunity to actually develop intercultural skills interacting with other children who may speak the other language as a native speaker and may come from the culture of that target language. So I think you're seeing the turnaround coming really with the very young learners. And it's really being driven, of course, by foreign language educators. We're all language advocates. Now, I serve as chair of the AATF Commission on Advocacy, and we all are at all levels. But it really, I think the driving force in this particular movement really has been families, has been communities, has been parents. They, for a variety of reasons, including all of the benefits of foreign language knowledge, they have been advocating, lobbying. It's hard to go online and read the news.
And Kathy, I want to pause right here because we have a great question to bring in. Kurt is joining us from Milwaukee with thoughts on this. Kurt, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I know many students, including my own children, across the state of Wisconsin, as I'm sure thousands and thousands, who have taken 4 years of high school foreign language, and they pass with flying colors, but they cannot speak a lick of it, and it seems to be a very large waste in many, many instances.
So what Kurt's saying there is the outcome isn't there. There isn't the fluency, and it seems like they're just doing it for the prerequisite or the requirement. Kathy?
Well, you know, that is a great question, and thank you, Kurt, for your interest in foreign language learning. You know, the fact that you described the experience your own children had and the fact that they did study a foreign language but did not develop fluency is a real challenge that foreign language education has faced.
And let's pause right there. We're talking about the steep decline in foreign language instruction in the U.S. with Kathy Stein-Smith as our guide. She's an associate university librarian at Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you fluent in another language? Tell us about it. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the foreign language deficit on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. New data out from the MLA, the Modern Language Association, finds that Spanish had a net loss of 118 program closures over a three-year period. French lost 129, German 86. And close to home, UW-Stevens Point announced plans almost a year ago to eliminate 13 humanities majors to chip away at its deficit. And last November, that plan was whittled down to 6 low-performing majors, but French and German were not spared. What do you think is behind the declining number of foreign language classes, and what do you think it would take to reverse this trend? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Fairleigh Dickinson University Associate Librarian Kathy Stein-Smith stays with us. She's been writing about the decline of foreign language instruction. Let's go to Glenn now, joining us from Minocqua. Hi, Glenn.
Yes, hello. I don't have an answer for what's behind it or what's going to help us get back to it, but I know parental involvement helped a lot in our situation. We have 2 daughters who are fluent in Spanish and French, and one of them is proficient in German. And one of them actually teaches French and Spanish in Boston. The other is in Spain teaching English right now after doing the same thing in France. But what got our girl started was when our youngest was 12, she wanted to go over to Austria to spend a couple of months with her aunt who married an Austrian and had a couple of little cousins there for her to help her. She was older. They were 2. She was 12. And we told her, you need to spend a year with a German tutor here, where we were living at the time in Oregon, before you do that. Because if you're going to go over there for 4 or 5 months, we want you to come back having learned some of the language. And we found a retired teacher, German war bride, actually, who scared our daughter to death. And after 3 weeks, my daughter said, I can't do this. She scares me. And I had to talk to the woman and say, you know, I'm sorry, it's not going to work out. And the woman just totally broke down. She so loved my daughter, we didn't realize it. She offered to do it for free. She offered to come to our house instead of going to their house.
Oh, goodness.
Homeschooled through 8th grade. And I couldn't say no to her. I said, we won't let you do it for free, but if you'll come to the house, okay. And she came to the house, and all of a sudden, my daughter felt safe. The woman understood she was a little too stern. My daughter, to this day, who's 30 years old, still calls her twice a month.
Oh, goodness.
So they live on both ends of the continent. She's been a third grandmother to my daughter.
It sounds like it was just a beautiful relationship that sprung out of language. Kathy?
You know, that is a beautiful story, and it highlights the importance, the role of parents. You know, I recently moderated a panel at the New York State Bilingual Fair on fostering and encouraging bilingualism in the home. And Glenn and his family have really done all of the perfect things to encourage that, and they've been successful. You know, one of the things that's important to remember is that foreign language teaching in our schools has changed. You know, a lot of the reasons for lack of proficiency and lack of fluency had to do with not staying in the target language in the classroom. And now, across the country, you know, foreign language classes are 90% in the target language. But in addition to that, and this is important, language is part of life. And so if you start a language in middle school and maybe you don't have an opportunity for continued study, and maybe you just have it 2 or 3 times a week for 40 minutes, it's hard to advance. But technology has been wonderful. There are all kinds of online opportunities to hear authentic speech, to hear native speakers, first language speakers, mother tongue speakers, and there are opportunities to travel. And if travel is not an option, there are opportunities to attend summer camps, summer immersion programs. Some of the most famous are really, Middlebury, Concordia, and many, many, many more. But I think that the importance really is making language part of your life.
Let's bring in another call now. Let's go to George in Monroe. George, hi.
Hi. I am a decent Spanish speaker. I have a 5-year-old granddaughter, and I have made it my mission to try to help her learn Spanish. And you said there's a lot of online resource, but I'm frankly pretty disgusted by what I find online. You can get stuff that tells people, you know, here's how you say the colors, or here's how you say hippopotamus and giraffe, and shows them pictures. But that's so unhelpful in terms of, and if you get cartoons or something that are made for Spanish-speaking kids, it's just, I mean, I can't understand it, let alone expect her to understand it. So I'd be interested in, you know, maybe off the air or something, but what are some of the resources that are sort of engaging and catchy, but are teaching kids, you know, how to say a sentence, not how to say a hippopotamus?
And certainly at that age level, Kathy, a five-year-old, where is the, you know, where are some of the resources?
You know, I think the first thing we have to realize is that language learning really has at least two stages. And one is the stage where children, even when they're learning their mother tongue, children are listening. You know, even if it's your first language as a child that you learn, little babies hear a lot of language. They don't necessarily produce perfect language and complete sentences until really several years later. And it's the same thing with the second language. You have to, the learner, the child, has to hear a certain amount of language. It's quality and quantity of language that will foster and encourage fluency. So in the case of Spanish, they would need to be hearing Spanish spoken on a variety of topics, and then they would need to hear a lot of Spanish being spoken. Now, there are, without naming any products on the air, there are actually products that are, you download children's stories, for example, from the cloud. And when you've exhausted that that particular group of stories, you download more. And so the child does not get bored, but yet if the parent or the grandparent or the family member cannot be with the child all the time speaking in the target language, there are many tools of technology that will help, even from the littlest ages. But it is important to remember that it's unrealistic to expect a language learner, let's just say a five-year-old child, to immediately start to speak. Because think of that process when, as a baby, you're learning your mother tongue. You don't immediately launch into speech.
Let's squeeze in one more call here. Georgiana in Milwaukee. Hi, Georgiana.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I am a kindergarten teacher at the Milwaukee German Immersion School, and I just want to give a shout-out to Milwaukee Public Schools because we have immersion programs here that are free of charge and that families can attend, and their children start in K-4, and they go up to fifth grade, and they're leaving speaking fluent French, German, Spanish, Italian.
Georgiana, do you see that immersion schools are very healthy and robust?
Healthy, robust. I think there needs to be a lot more information out there to the public that we exist, so more people enroll and are a part of this program.
Georgiana, thanks for calling in. Kathy, immersion schools, public schools, they exist.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you, Georgiana, for the work that you and your colleagues do. I think this is a big part of the turnaround in foreign language education. If we look to Canada, we can see really 50-plus years of immersion learning and really the support of the official bilingualism of Canada, but then translating it into our own U.S. setting. For example, you have immersion programs in New York City, my area of the country, in at least a dozen languages. You have, in Georgia, you've got large numbers of immersion programs. And so on and so forth, really, across the country. The latest figures, official figures, were in the 400s. Newspaper articles that I've seen are saying there are maybe 1,500 immersion programs in the country. And it's a wonderful way to foster bilingualism in a new language and also to support heritage language learners and communities. And heritage language, you have to realize, it's not necessarily the language that you speak in the home. I mean, it can be. Over 60 million Americans speak a language other than English in the home. But it can also be a semi-forgotten heritage language. A family maybe has been here for several generations, and typically people, well, it might have a few words, might have varying levels of knowledge of that heritage language. These immersion programs can also strengthen these communities, and people can rediscover their heritage languages.
And Kathy, we're almost out of time here, but are you optimistic that this will turn around?
I am absolutely optimistic. I think what we're seeing in the elementary schools, whether it's traditional foreign language instruction or immersion, I think that is the beginning of the resurgence of foreign language skills in the United States. What's important for us is to make sure all of our children have that opportunity.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity, and best wishes to you in the important work that you do.
Kathleen Stein-Smith is an associate university librarian at Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey, and she's taught foreign languages at the high school and college level, written several books on the U.S. foreign language deficit. Her recent piece for the website The Conversation is titled Foreign Language Classes Becoming More Scarce. Coming up, the American Civil Liberties Union is starting an effort to reduce the prison population in Wisconsin. It's called Smart Justice, and we'll hear about it after the news. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the ACLU's Smart Justice campaign here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The figures are stark. African Americans are incarcerated in state prisons at a rate that is five times that of whites. In Wisconsin and four other states, that disparity is more than 10 to 1. The American Civil Liberties Union is starting an effort to reduce the prison population here in Wisconsin. You can join in with your perspective on the state's criminal justice system at 800-642-1234. Where do you see opportunities to change the criminal justice system? Is there a model that you want to talk about? Have you or someone you know been incarcerated in Wisconsin as the result of a mandatory minimum sentence? What happened and how has that affected your life? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Emilio De Torre is Director of Community Engagement for the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin. Emilio, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you.
And Sean Wilson is with us as well. He's a statewide organizer for the ACLU's campaign for Smart Justice. Sean, welcome to you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Well, let's start with Emilio. This weekend, the ACLU of Wisconsin will begin trainings to help people speak up at upcoming hearings for the state budget. What are you training them to do here?
Oh, well, this is really exciting, Kate, and it's a relatively new and broad approach for the ACLU of Wisconsin. And so we've partnered with a lot of other community groups like Wisconsin Public Education Network and WILD, Wisconsin Voices, Expo, interfaith groups like Wisdom. And this first set of trainings in February, which will take place in Middleton, Kaukauna, Milwaukee, and Eau Claire, will train folks to learn how to testify at the Joint Finance Committee. They'll learn a little about how the incredibly unsexy budget process works and how to tie their own personal stories into what they'd like to see advocated for in a budget. We have billions and billions of dollars in the state of our tax dollars, and where that's sent is generally not determined by the people of Wisconsin, and this is our chance to make it more of a people's budget.
And so a lot of the focus of the testimony is focusing on ending mass incarceration. And in Wisconsin, the goal for these budget hearings is to convince lawmakers that cutting down on incarceration rates will save money, and that money can be spent on education. Sean, why did the ACLU decide that any savings should go to education?
We understand that investment in people is more important than investment in prisons. So we understand that we have an educational system that continues to be slashed, and that slashing goes to our prisons. So we believe that we need to invest more into our educational system and divest from the prison system, because if we focus more on our education system, we can kind of dismantle that school-to-prison pipeline. We have schools here in Milwaukee that are suffering from books, computers. So I think if we invest more in our educational system, we can dismantle that school-to-prison pipeline.
Sean, throw out some numbers for us. What is the cost of imprisonment, and what does the ACLU estimate the state would save by reducing the number of people in its prisons?
Well, currently, the corrections bill the corrections budget is $1.2 billion. It costs $30,000 to house one adult, man or woman, in prison. And we're spending $110,000 to house young people. One of our campaign goals is to end crimeless revocation. Crimeless revocation is the reincarceration of men and women who are released from prison and violate a minor technical rule of probation or parole. We're sending 3,000 men and women back to prison each year for that alone. And that is at a cost of $140 million. The facility which houses these people, it costs $40 million to operate that, and that is the Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility. So if we addressed our crimeless revocation issue, if we end crimeless revocation, we will be saving upwards of $200 to $300 million of a year.
Emilio, Wisconsin, the ACLU has a really ambitious goal here to cut prison populations by 50%. So how do you intend to roll that out on a timeline? How do you scale up to meet that goal?
That's a great question, Kate. And I think it's important to put things in context for the listeners, too. Wisconsin is a grotesque outlier in the way that we incarcerate humans. So our state of Wisconsin incarcerates about 676 per 100,000, which is more than the United Kingdom, Portugal, Canada, Denmark, you know, pick a country. And the amount of money we're spending on the Department of Corrections to incarcerate these folks is also grotesque. We're looking at $2.7 billion per budget cycle, which is a two-year click. And each year this goes up. So this year, the previously submitted budget is asking for an additional $157 million, say. And that's not even including their desire to build new prisons. If we start taking a look at cutting off the school-to-prison pipeline, like Sean was discussing, talking about investing money in local treatment, in AODA treatments, alcohol and other drug addiction treatment, in getting therapy and getting vocational training, getting in stopping our habit of policing mental health and policing poverty and policing race, that's going to be a huge drop-off. And this isn't a partisan issue. This isn't a Democrat or Republican issue. You take a look at states like Texas and Mississippi and Michigan. They're shutting down prisons. They're taking that money and they're investing it back in the people. Locking folks up for years is just some sort of expensive time out. And then once they're released on probation and parole, the cards are stacked against them and every chance is given for them to violate and not to reenter and embrace their support groups, their families, you know, get a meaningful, sustainable career. I think that we'll find as we travel around and as we've already found, because our message of divestment from the criminal justice system and investment into the public education system is not just an ACLU talking point. This is what we've heard after countless community meetings all around the state.
We're learning about the ACLU's plan to reduce the state's prison population with Sean Wilson. He's a statewide organizer for the ACLU's Campaign for Smart Justice, and Emilio De Torre, Director of Community Engagement for the ACLU of Wisconsin. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Where do you see areas of potential reform with Wisconsin's criminal justice system? Do you think that mental health issues should be taken into account when determining how much time someone should do? Call in. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sean, let's take a step back for a moment for those who might be thinking, why do we need to reduce the prison population? People are in prison for a reason. Can you tell us a bit about why the ACLU is trying to reduce the prison population when this is a type of punishment for a crime?
Well, we don't deny that people should be held accountable for their actions. That's first and foremost. We understand the importance of public safety, but we want people to know that public safety, criminal justice reform, is not at the expense of public safety. We want people to know that we have a prison system that was designed to house 17,000, and that is the design capacity. And we know that the design capacity is always under its original capacity. So we are currently housing 23,000 people in our prisons right now. We have 66,000 men and women on the community supervisions, probation and parole. But what we're saying is that a lot of these men and women suffer from mental health issues. We know that a lot of these men and women suffer from alcohol and drug abuse. So what we're saying is that we need to be more focused on treating these individuals for the trauma that has led them into these cages. We need to be treating them for the drug abuse that has contributed to them making poor decisions and leading them into prison. So we're not saying that just do away with public safety and let everyone out of prison. What we're saying is that we need a more equitable criminal justice system that is going to look at each case that comes before it and treat each case accordingly. We understand and we know that the criminal justice system is a racist institution. We know that this is a system that is built upon white supremacy and it is fueled by systemic racism. We know that the prison industrial complex is it's an extension of slavery. So with all of these factors being the case, this is a system that needs to not only be reformed, but dismantled.
Emilio, as you travel the state, you are talking with people and you are preparing them to go in front of lawmakers. What are the stories you're trying to convey?
We are trying to provide an opportunity for Wisconsin residents to have some say in what the state of Wisconsin does in their name and with their money. By working with such a broad coalition of people, folks from churches, parents who care about their children's education in small rural towns, teachers in Green Bay and Racine, we're just training folks so that they have a bit of understanding about how these 16 people in the Joint Finance Committee, these 8 senators and 8 representatives, are going to begin to divide out their money. And we're going to give them a chance to have their 2-minute say and explain exactly what's important to them. And what's wonderful is probably not surprising is that young folks all around the state, high school and college students, really felt as though they had no voice. And we've been able to get, even just for this upcoming weekend, 54 college and high school students will be coming to the training in Milwaukee, whereby they will in turn train hundreds of other young folks at the March training. And we found well over a couple hundred adults that are looking to train in these 4 places, and all of them want to bring in 5 or more adults to go to these Joint Finance Committee hearings around the state and have their say.
We're talking with Emilio De Torre and Sean Wilson about the ACLU's effort to cut the state's prison population in half. You can join in 800-642-1234. Where do you see reform happening in the state criminal justice system? Call in. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking with the ACLU about a plan to reduce the prison population in Wisconsin, focusing more on education. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One of the first things that Governor Tony Evers did last month was tour the troubled juvenile correctional facilities, Lincoln Hills School for Boys. Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake School for Girls are slated for closure in the next couple years, and they've been under federal investigation in recent years for allegations of abuse. Your thoughts are welcome here at 800-642-1234. How would you like Wisconsin to approach criminal justice and prisons? What do you think of the ACLU's plan? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. 2 guests from the ACLU stay with us. Emilio De Torre is Director of Community Engagement for the ACLU of Wisconsin. Sean Wilson here as well, statewide organizer for the ACLU's Campaign for Smart Justice. Calls on the line here. Let's bring in Sarah now in Milwaukee with thoughts on this. Sarah, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to kind of push back against the term crimeless revocation. As somebody who has worked in the criminal justice system for part of that time as a probation and parole agent, I don't know anybody who was revoked or had their supervision revoked, I should say, for simple rule violations alone. In fact, it was almost always related to behaviors that would be, if charged out, new felonious activities. And oftentimes I would notice that the district attorney's office would not pick up a case because somebody was on supervision with the state of Wisconsin.
Sean, do you want to jump in there?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your question. But we have, it's the DOC reports that every crimeless revocation, technical rule violation, however you want to frame it, is a result of a rules-only violation, meaning that one of the 18 standard rules of supervision is the reason as to why these individuals have been revocated. There, it may be an accumulation of these rules, but the DOC reports that these are the reasons as to why these individuals have been sent back to prison. And 3,000 is a lot of people to be sending back to prison for a rules-only violation. And if there is a reason why the DA's office defer to prosecute because they know that this individual is going to be revocated, then there needs to be some type of data that informs of that.
Sean, this is an issue that hits close to you. You were incarcerated at the age of 17, served 17 years behind bars. Can you tell us about that time, how it impacted your life?
Absolutely. So at the age of 17, as you said, I was sent to prison. I was given what I lived on earth for a crime that I committed when I was a child. I don't deny that I should not have been held accountable for my actions. As young folks, we have youthful indiscretion. We're peer pressured into doing things that we wouldn't normally do if we were mature enough to make the rational decisions. So as a result of my youthful indiscretion and coupled with peer pressure, I was sent to prison. And in prison, I didn't allow this system to break me, which is it's intended to do just that. Instead, I decided to, you know, transform my life. I began to, you know, read and study. And in the words of a good friend of mine, you know, I took that 17 years and went to school and earned an honorary degree in criminal justice. And now I'm using that degree to dismantle this system called mass incarceration. But the impact that prison has had upon me has been very traumatic. You know, while I was in prison, I've served time in solitary confinement for challenging the policies and procedures that the administrator of these prisons put forth. And as a result of that, I was put in solitary confinement for standing up for that which is right. I lost my grandmother while I was in prison. 2 weeks before I was released from prison, my grandmother died, the woman who raised me, the woman who got on the highway every weekend and made sure that, you know, she came and saw me. There's so many things that there's so many ways that, you know, being in prison has impacted me, some for the better and some for the bad. And the bad is that I'm still dealing with the trauma of solitary confinement. You know, I'm still dealing with the trauma of having conversations with men who have life sentences, who don't never have a day, you know, just thinking about, you know, these individuals, you know. So I'm doing this work because I know that I was a victim of a system that victimized me, and this system continues to victimize others, not only here in Wisconsin, but all over the country, with 2.3 million men and women in cages.
Let's look at mandatory minimum sentences for a moment with Carol in Madison joining us. Carol, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I was just listening to the program, and what I wanted to say was that we really need to look at mandatory minimum sentences and look at changing those, because if you look at the drunk driving laws that kill thousands of people a year, generally across the country, the mandatory minimum for a first offense is like 2 days. the mandatory minimum for a second offense is 2 to 10. And in Wisconsin, we know that this is really low. But things change if you're looking at, let's say, crack cocaine. Crack cocaine disproportionately affects the black community. And it doesn't, mostly it does not kill people. But the mandatory minimum for a first offense for a small amount of crack cocaine is 5 years.
And Carol, I want to pause right there because I want Emilio to jump in here with one of the changes the ACLU wants states to make is to end mandatory minimum sentences. Can you speak to that?
Sure. I think Carol hit the nail on the head. The gross injustice of how this is, the way that the disproportionate sentencing structure is based on racialized terms, how there are completely and apparently a completely different set of rules that are applied to folks that are black and brown or folks that are impoverished based compared to other folks is something that needs to be removed. You can look back, a quick search will reveal how often even judges who are trained, judges who are you know, scholars of the law are crying from the bench because their ability to meet a just sentence in their eyes has been stripped away due to the existence of mandatory minimums. That's one of many things that has to go.
Emilio, what opportunities does the ACLU of Wisconsin see with Governor Tony Evers in office and an end to Lincoln Hills a closure in 2021?
Well, I see perhaps a greater opportunity for civic engagement here. There's no administrative rule changes just coming from the governor's office isn't enough to begin to break apart our mass incarceration system. It's a start, but it's not the same. The real change that people need to take is now. They need to get involved in these budget action workshops that folks are setting up around the state because legislative change needs to occur too. And I would invite people that are interested in getting involved to go to Facebook and look up budget action workshops, or they can, you know, you can call my cell phone, 415-8569,
well,
and I'll plug you into it.
I want Sean to get the last word in here with a few seconds we have left. Sean, when people are released from jail, they aren't always prepared to reenter society. How can the criminal justice system improve in this area?
They can do a better job in job training. They can do a better job in providing programs for reentry. We're hopeful with this new administration coming in, and we look forward to holding them accountable to the promises that they've made on the campaign trail. But I think that, you know, more job training can be very beneficial.
Thank you both for joining us. Emilio Dottore is Director of Community Engagement for the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin. Sean Wilson, statewide organizer for the ACLU's Campaign for Smart Justice. We've been talking about an effort by the ACLU to reduce incarceration. You hear this conversation on the morning show. It is the Ideas Network.